From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program. You all know Pat Brown as a profiler. Her book, The Profiler, My Life Hunting Serial Killers and Psychopaths, of course, is available at Amazon and other book retailers. And you can click on the link in the show notes to check out her webpage. You can find Pat on many of the different cable news shows, Nancy Grace among them, and it's always nice to have her on the show. Hi, Pat. How are you?
Hi, Dana. How are you doing?
I'm good. You told me off air that you're sitting on your porch tonight, and
I am,
and thinking, and good for you. We all deserve to do that now and then. You're not in a rocking chair, I hope. You're not that age yet.
No, I'm not doing one of those. Chairs you step on the porch when you're cheap.
You know, that would be an awesome reality show. Have a rocking chair knitting. A grandmother profiler. That would be awesome.
Well, that probably is coming out next year. We'll see what happens. My book, the profiler, has been taken up by Warner Brothers, so we'll see if a television series comes up. But if they portray me as that old lady on the porch, I'm going to be pissed.
Yeah, I don't.
I'm looking for a really hot female to be me. So.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Listen, we're going to talk a little bit in a little bit about the Long Island serial killing, but I got to get your thoughts on Osama bin Laden and how it affects you, and your thoughts on the war on terror itself. A few years back, you and I have talked about this because it's probably a profiler's dream to sit down and think about a person like Osama bin Laden. And now we're hearing lots in the media, and the big debate now is whether or not to release his photograph. I don't know, one way or the other, if you want to see him with a hole in his head. I hear it was a mind-blowing experience for him. Drum roll. No, anyway.
But you would have to say. That,
yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Anyway, your thoughts on...
My joke of the week is that there's 72 virgins up in heaven saying, oh, hell no.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Anyway, your thoughts on Osama and the capture of him?
Well, you know, I'm conflicted on some of this because some of it I'm not quite understanding exactly how it went down. I'm sure there's a lot of information we're just not getting as to what occurred. One of the things I think which kind of puzzles people, including the Pakistanis in the area, is how there was this massive compound with a big army facility right nearby that nobody had a clue that Osama was in there. I think that just kind of people are going, how could that be? Mm-hmm. And of course the ISI, that's the intelligence organization there, is saying they had no clue. But then, you know, I don't trust much of the ISI has to say anyway, because there's a very famed man, an Indian criminal. His name is Dawood Ibrahim. He's one of the, he's on the most wanted list in Interpol, and he was the one who authored the 1993 Mumbai bombings on the train, and he's worth the billions, and he's been hooked up with Osama bin Laden, and everybody knows he's hanging out in Pakistan with the ISI. Well, no, they're not really protecting him, but, you know, he's just hanging out in Pakistan for God knows how long now. And it's even been said that he has parties there, and the ships in Bollywood, you know, ladies to come and, you know, spice up the place. And it's like, well, how come he's still sitting here then? You know, because he's considered one of the most dangerous men in the world and being hooked up with Al-Qaeda. So, I mean, knowing that for years, I mean, you wonder how ISI did not know Osama bin Laden is sitting in that complex there. Not one person, you know, let the word out that a guy that looks just like Osama sitting inside this massive complex. Yeah. It just seems a little odd.
Yeah, exactly. Pat Brown is here. When you look at the killing capture, whatever you want to call it, of this, we all know, if you sit down and think about it practically that it's the war on terror and radical Islam is still out there, and even though the United States and North America to a point have been protected over the last 10 years and there haven't been any major terror attacks, that possibility is still there. Is this just more of a patriotic punch in the arm for the states? Good, we finally got this guy. I see it more like that, but the way the media is portraying it, it almost seems like in some cases like it's all over, we can sit back and relax. In fact, I saw a story the other day, Pat, it was so dopey, about talking about shampoo in your carry-on, and now that Osama's dead, maybe you can start putting shampoo back in your carry-on.
Yeah.
That's so stupid.
Sure. Well, you know, Osama hasn't been doing all that much for the last gosh knows how many years either, so, I mean, I've heard personally was surprised that he was, shot down just recently, because I thought he's been dead for 5 to 8 years because of the kidney problems and the fact that there really wasn't much coming out and he wasn't seeming to mastermind anything. I kind of thought that he might have already gone, but so I'm sure that there's, he's not going to have, the death of him is not going to have that massive an impact as far as somebody's not going to carry on the tradition with Al-Qaeda and everything else. But I do think the useful part is every time you take down one of the major players,
mm-hmm.
I do think that does send a message in general. It disrupts things, and it says, we're out there, we're going to get you, and if the next guy moves in, we're going to get you too.
Yep.
So I think the more time you can take these guys out, the better off you are. So I can't complain about it. I think it's a good thing. So I'm happy about it, but yes, it's not going to stop terrorism in its tracks, but I think that, the more that we are against terrorism, the less they're going to be able to do to us. So I think we have to stay on that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's one off the list, and now there's many more to go after. Pat Brown, criminal profiler, is here. Let's turn our thoughts now to Long Island. Some have called it the body dumping ground. Some have brought up the term serial killer. It has gone many different ways. Not so much in the media lately with other stories taking over, but nevertheless an important story. Pat, your thoughts on the Long Island case?
Well, it's definitely a serial killer. I mean, you don't have that many bodies in one place if it's not. I mean, it's just impossible. It is a body dumping ground. He found a good one until, finally somebody tripped over one of the bodies and said, then he's like, well, darn, can't use that anymore. So I don't think he's running around there right now committing any particular crimes in the area. So I think all the people in Long Island actually at this moment are safer than they were before the bodies were found. The question is, can they ever figure out who it is? And that's going to be the major problem here, because he did a good job when he dumped them, in the sense that I've heard at least that the bodies were nude, possibly washed, because I believe he's a sadistic serial killer, which would mean to me he brings them into his lair and keeps them at his own place, which means afterwards then he can wash their bodies down, make sure there's no DNA, and eliminate all the objects with them and put them out there in a good place where the weather also has an effect on them. So I don't think they've got anything linking back to this person. I think that's what their big problem is going to be.
A lot of people don't understand the difference, and some in the media, in fact, don't understand the difference what a spree killer is compared to a serial killer. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it gets a little confusing sometimes. Generally, we look at a spree killer as something has gone wrong suddenly in their lives, and then they go on the run. Perhaps they end up shooting somebody at a gas station, and then they say, oh, what the hell? They're coming after me anyway. So they jump in a stolen vehicle, and they kill the driver of that vehicle, and then they keep going, and they just kill and kill and kill till basically they get shot down, kind of like a Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing. We look at something like the D.C. snipers. The question was, what the hell were they? Because they were kind of a weird mix, in a sense, because they had a lot of the serial killer mentality of picking a target, going out there, shooting somebody down, and then going back into hiding and, waiting to do it again. But on the other hand, they were doing them awful close together, so that pushed it to a spree. So they're both psychopaths. They're both killing because they get pleasure out of it, the thrill of the power and control for whatever time. But the serial killer, the most important thing about a serial killer is that he wants to continue doing this for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want to be shot down in a month or two or have the police chasing him. He wants to get away with it. And that's what the Long Island serial killer clearly is. He has total intentions of continuing his hobby if he can do it.
How important is intel in something like this? Intelligence, let's go back to Osama for a minute. Not only did they get a good start, one of my listeners emails me to killing Osama as a good start, but they got all this intel from all the computers and all this. There's a lot of intelligence going around when it comes to investigating a case like this. Although the police aren't saying much, I'm sure they're looking at that. How much is intel important when it comes to an investigation like the serial killer case?
Well, in this case, because the Craigslist is out there, and the internet was used for that, that he was making contact with some of his victims, at least, through Craigslist, there is some usefulness in that, although I don't know how useful it's going to be. It all depends what they've come up with, whether the women wrote information down, whether there was anything left on their computers. I'm sure they're going through every shred of that. I don't know how much of a dope he was, though. It's, you know, so far he looks like he's done a pretty good job of covering his tracks. Although the fellow that kind of started this whole thing, the guy went on Craigslist, and remember that the woman he brought to his home went screaming away saying he's trying to kill me, or they're trying to kill me.
Right.
They said they went to his home and found nothing, at least that's what they said, and he's supposedly not a suspect at this time, but of course he has to be a suspect. I don't see how he could not be. And that's usually how serial killers actually get caught, as a living victim, somebody who escapes them and can identify them or say, you know, bring the police to their place, and then they find a cache of stuff. But we don't hear anything happening like that, so he may just be another creep that went on Craigslist and acted weird. So it just happened to start this whole thing. But they haven't found that woman, though. I don't know where she went to. So it's a real peculiar case as far as this most recent happening and all the discovery of all these women, but in other terms, it's not that unusual, because that is how sexual sadists work. They really plan much better than your kind of serial killer that jumps out of the bushes. But so I think, you know, they have a chance of finding him, but I hope there is some intel there, because if they don't have that, I don't know how to identify the person.
You know, some of the early reports in this case, Pat, I can think of BTK as an example, and other serial killer cases where there's been a law enforcement or a person in authority tie-in as far as the suspect goes.
Well, he was a dog catcher, so let's not denigrate him, was just a dog catcher.
Right, yeah.
He was a code enforcement dude. I mean, I don't think he's quite law enforcement. He was a wannabe.
He wasn't
law enforcement. And I know there are people saying, oh, it's going to be a cop. And that is actually pretty rare. I mean, there have been serial killer cops out there, but generally speaking, it is rare. I don't see it in this particular case. I think people jump to those conclusions when they see somebody getting away with things, or the police haven't been able to identify anybody. They say, oh, it must be a cop. That's kind of one of those. We see it quite often, but I don't see it in this case at all.
The law enforcement's taking some flack as far as cooperation with the family, not releasing a whole lot of information. We've seen cases, Pat, where law enforcement will release everything and anything, and then there's some cases where they keep everything close to the vest. Where do you draw the line down the middle in something like this? What should they do? What shouldn't they do?
Well, in my opinion, with serial killer cases, you release absolutely as much as you possibly can.
Yeah.
Everything you possibly can, because you have no idea who it is. It's not like you have a list of 10 suspects and you don't want to let information out because you don't want one of those 10 suspects to know you've got him and, you know, the target there. Then you might want to be a little more cautious because you're sneaking around, you know, doing a lot of other things. But with serial killer cases, the problem is you're looking out in the population, you're wondering who the heck it is out of all of those people out there. And you need the public's information as much as possible. So the more you give the public to work with, the better off you can, you know, get some information. Now, there is a kind of a drawback in that, I must admit, because, for example, the burlap bag situation. One of the problems with that is, on one hand, it's great information to give to the public. Because if a guy's got burlap bags, and he happens to live, I think, east of those bodies in Long Island, and he has some other peculiar psychopathic traits, very sadistic in his mannerisms, if he has those burlap bags, he's a good suspect for somebody to call in and say, look, this guy works in such and such business, he has burlap bags. But the downside of that is, I've had quite a number of calls from women who say they think they might know who this guy is, and they all say he's got burlap bags. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm beginning to wonder, are there really burlap bags associated with these particular men that they're calling me about, or are they just adding that in so they sound more legitimate? And that's the kind of stuff the police have to deal with. Now you get all these tips and you think, really? Now we've gotten, you know, 5,000 tips of men with burlap bags all residing within a mile of all the bodies were. Is that really possible? So you start questioning the veracity of the stories of your tipsters. So that becomes problematic. But so it's kind of a double-edged sword type of thing. But I think you do have to get the tips in. Otherwise, you're going to have no idea where to go look for the guy.
Pat Brown, criminal profiler, is here. We're talking about the Long Island murder case. In the past, again, talking about other stories, some of the suspects have gone to the media. They want to use the media. They want to have them broadcast their manifesto or tease them with little tidbits of information.
Extremely rare.
Okay.
Actually, it's extremely rare. We tend to think they do that because those are the ones that get all the publicity, obviously, and that makes the big cat and mouse game that everybody so loves. But in reality, almost none of them do that because they don't want to get caught. They simply want to continue the thrill that they're getting out of killing these women. And if they let that information out, then they're going to get screwed and they're going to get their hobby's going to be over. So it's a fairly rare thing that happens. In this particular case, we do have that incident of the man making a phone call to one of the victim's sisters and mocking, her and the sister that the victim that he obviously killed. So we do have that, but that's probably more of an impulse thing. Maybe the victim said something to him like, "Oh, don't hurt me, my little sister. You know, I have a little sister and she wants me to come home." And so after he killed her, he thought, "Well, I'll call your little sister up and tell her you're not coming home." It just amused him essentially. So I think sometimes just the fun of things gets the better of them, but I don't think it's not very common, so I don't think we can expect that this guy's going to start sending letters out there saying, "It's me, you know, I'm out here." Mm-hmm. A lot of time we see it's hoax letters, too.
Right.
That's what happened with Jack the Ripper. You know, those were the Jack letters that came out, and of course everybody said, "Oh my God, you know, Jack the Ripper is communicating," but I believe that was fraudulent. I believe Jack the Ripper never sent out any of those. And so you have to, you know, unfortunately when it gets into the media, and even back in the old days of London, things did get into the media, and somebody was going to jump on it and have fun with it.
A case you and I both covered pretty much from the beginning. We'll be going to trial here pretty quick. I'm talking about Casey Anthony. Your thoughts on where that will go? Trial of the century? I don't think so, but it will be interesting.
Yeah, it's going to. Obviously, people have been following this closely. Maybe they want to see the action in court. I think they all want to see Casey go down, essentially, for her snotty behavior. And I think the judge did a great thing. He's allowing it all, everything. Basically, the defense lost every attempt they had to try to prevent this all the evidence from coming in to the courtroom. And I think that's great because in this particular case, I think what they're trying to do is, what the prosecution is going to do is try to show a pattern here. And they don't want any holes in the pattern. They don't want her to be, maybe looking up something on the Internet like chloroform, and then there's no more information, and then the child just ends up, you know, someplace dead. And they say, well, then how do we connect her to? Just because she did that doesn't mean anything else. But if you can put all those little dots in a row, you know, she's looking up neck breaking, she's looking up chloroform, and then the next thing that she did, you know, then the child goes missing and the smell in the trunk, so she had the child in the trunk, and then the child ends up near the house, and then she goes partying. You know, all of these things in a row, I think, are going to show that she was involved in this every step of the way and that her psychology or psychopathy was there every step of the way. So I think the judge did a great thing. I think the defense is in big trouble, and I think she's going to go down. My only concern is whether, you know, what the actual sentence is going to be, whether somebody's going to have enough sympathy for her to think, well, she's severely disturbed because she came from Cindy Anthony, so therefore you can't really blame her for being, you know, the way she is, so maybe she just lost her mind because of Sidney Anthony, so we'll give her a break, we'll give her life instead of a death penalty. I'd like to see her get the death penalty because I know it was a premeditated crime. We can see that. It wasn't any accident she tried to cover up. And I think the partying part of it, that really kind of negates the accident issue. Because if it had truly been an accident and then she just tried to cover up, she would have been so shaken, she would have been so beside herself, she wouldn't have been able to act so cheerful and chipper and be having such a great time. So I think that shows that there was a premeditation.
Absolutely. Pat Brown, as always, thank you, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All righty. Okay, bye.
That's criminal profiler Pat Brown, and yeah, it looks like her book may become a TV show here pretty soon, and all the years that I've been interviewing Pat Brown, it will be a good one. My executive producer sends me a note, read, and it's a good one. It says, looks like waterboarding is justified after all, and Obama was wrong. Looks like it was waterboarding that started the road to get bin Laden, as the names and contacts were referenced due to some nice old waterboarding. Since then, Obama ended it by executive orders. Yeah, I saw the interview with O'Reilly last night, I believe it was, and it's going to be interesting. It's interesting to see how the left has really turned this into a Barbara Walters, I think, was the one that said you might as well cancel the election now because Obama will be reelected because of Osama bin Laden's capture and death. Well, there's a lot more to running the United States than just that, and people aren't stupid, that's for sure. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with Mike McIntyre, syndicated radio host, author, and crime reporter, and get his perspective on what's been going on lately. And this is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. You all know Mike McIntyre is a syndicated radio talk show host on the Ralco and Chorus radio networks. He's the author of true crime books and the crime reporter at the Winnipeg Free Press. And rumors are that he and Michael Ignatieff are going to be starting their own lemonade stand here pretty soon, but I'm not sure about that. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I may have been just as successful in Quebec, or perhaps more successful in the province of Quebec than Mr. Ignatieff, and I guess unlike him, I'm still working today.
You know,
instead of a job.
For those that are wondering what the hell we're talking about, the Canadian election was yesterday, and Michael Ignatieff, who was the leader of the Liberal Party, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring Mike on tonight to talk about the crime platform of all three of these leaders and what this means for Canada now. The Liberals were always the, or accused to be, the soft-on-crime crew. And in fact, one of Ignatieff's campaign promises was he wouldn't be like the Conservative Party that won the election, wouldn't be making super prisons and buying a bunch of fighter jets. So let's talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about what it means now to Canada to have a majority Conservative government and their crime bill that they've been talking about.
Yeah, well, certainly a majority government as opposed to a minority government, and for those, I guess, outside of Canada, they may be wondering, well, what is the difference? The fact is the Conservatives, as of today, now control the majority of the seats in the House of Commons, and that is, provided all their members toe the party line, they don't need help from any of the other parties out there to get certain bills passed, legislation. They form the majority government, and that's a big change from how our government stood previous to this election, and it's a big cause of the fact that we've seemingly had an election every year for the last few years. The Conservatives have made no secret about the fact that they are taking a tough-on-crime approach, that they're more than just tough talk. They're also going to walk the walk, and I think what happened in this election signals a real potential shift in how our country deals with crime and with criminals, because the Conservatives now are free to pursue the kind of legislation that they have been talking about for some time that has run into, in certain instances, run into opposition and have been very difficult to pass. And I know the Conservatives have long advanced a platform of trying to right some of the perceived wrongs of the former Liberal Party. One of those big wrongs being the Youth Criminal Justice Act, or the old Young Offenders Act. Youth crime in Canada is a major, major issue these days, and it's long been perceived that the Liberal Party took a massive step backwards in how they were dealing with youth criminals, and now the Conservatives are promising to really crack down, and I think we could see a real shift, especially when it comes to youth crime in some of the penalties that are handed out.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre is here. The Long Gun Registry was something that has been talked about for so long. A lot of people don't understand unless you're from the prairies or you're a hunter or you really, you know, give a darn about something like this. But it was a huge, some will claim, boondoggle that cost millions, if not billions of dollars, that was doing nothing. Let's talk about the Long Gun Registry and what the Conservative government up here in Canada will do with it.
Well, a long time thorn in the sides of many law-abiding citizens who feel that in some ways they've been criminalized or somehow made to feel bad about the fact that they do own legally own firearms. And you know, of course, opponents of any gun registry will say, and I think rightfully so, that the vast majority of crimes that are being committed out there are by criminals who have illegally obtained weapons and who are not going to register their firearms. They'll find a way to get their hands on these guns. And that's true, and you could say that certainly about all kinds of crime. In my province, there's been a real push to crack down on car thieves and go after their licenses, to which I say, well, geez, the majority of car thieves don't even have licenses to begin with. What is taking away their license going to do? And I think to the same degree, you could argue, what is forcing law-abiding citizens to adhere to what are certainly very costly procedural regulations, how is that going to really cut down on crime? And I've yet to really hear an intelligent argument advanced as to how somehow the criminal element will be persuaded to stay away from gun crime, which has become an increasing problem in this country.
Absolutely, and the community you live in, by gosh, every time you turn the news on, there's another scary gun call, incident, shooting, murder, you name it, and this Long Gun Registry certainly hasn't done much to quell that. But again, Mike, when you talk about a majority government, and now we have a ruling government that can actually do something, and again, if everyone toes the party line, one of the big platforms of the Conservatives in Canada was mandatory minimum sentences like the United States, something that's never really been seen up here in Canada.
Right.
They've also discussed this omnibus crime bill that they plan to push through very quickly here. Let's talk about mandatory minimums and what Canadians may see in the next month.
Well, mandatory minimums are something that certainly are being discussed, and that would mean that, like the board game Monopoly, go directly to jail, do not pass go. It would remove the possibility of a non-custodial sentence. In this country, in Canada, conditional sentences are a very thorny issue, and some people's blood pressure shoots up as soon as you say the term conditional sentence. Conditional sentence, for the those who don't know what I'm talking about, it's kind of like house arrest. They call it sort of being a prisoner in your own home. But certainly there's evidence to suggest that there's not a lot of follow-up done, and that people who are on these so-called sentences of house arrest are free to more or less do as they please, and often do as they please without fear of getting caught. The big question, though, with mandatory minimums is that if we all of a sudden create this sort of new tier in sentencing that says, the following offenses, A, B, C, and D, are all going to result in mandatory jail sentences, obviously there's going to be a tremendous spike in how many people are actually going to jail, and that creates quite the dilemma, because as we sit here today, I can tell you that institutions across this country are bursting at the seams. There are already far too many people in custody for what these institutions were designed to hold. Throw in all kinds of volatile gang tension and the frustration that goes along with overcrowding, and you've got a powder keg in a lot of these cases. And this isn't just me saying it. We hear it from guards all the time. We hear it from those directly involved in the system who aren't saying this as a means of trying to get sentences reduced or to defer people from jail. They're saying that this is a serious health and safety issue for those who have to work in these institutions, And that brings up the whole other point, Dana, of course, and that is building more prisons, or these super prisons, as you called them. And I think that is something that is very much a reality now in this country. We're going to see the construction, and in fact, we're going to have to see the building of more prisons if some of these policies are going to hold water.
And some of the facilities, like the one here in Saskatchewan, is so old that the escapes have increased because they're scratching their way out of them. Literally, the walls are crumbling.
And not only that, and how many times, Dana, have we seen just in the last couple of years these embarrassing stories of people being accidentally released? I know Saskatchewan had a real run of them, and you know they were being sort of mocked and ridiculed. But I think when you start to see those happening time and time again, that speaks to the stress on the system, the utter confusion and chaos that exists. And, you know, you're going to have more and more of those situations if something isn't done about overcrowding.
Mike McIntyre is here. His website, MikeOnCrime.com, will show you lots about Mike, about his books, his radio show, and everything else that he's been up to. Let's talk about judges and the provinces and how they're appointed. A little different situation up here than it is in the United States, but there has been talk in the past about maybe there'll be a different way of how someone becomes a judge nowadays, because some judges in this country are not going to like some of the rules that the conservatives are going to come out with.
No, that's true. And of course, in this country, unlike our brothers and sisters to the south, where they elect their judiciary, we don't. Our judges are appointed in this country, and certainly on the federal level, they are appointed by our government. The provincial level, it's a little different. There's committees struck that are comprised of all kinds of members of the public that cross all party lines. So on the provincial level, when you talk provincial court judges, it's not such a big deal. But I think federally, when you look at federal judicial appointments, for sure, and, you know, there's been some discussion, are we headed potentially for an American-style system, which could potentially include electing our judges? I'm not convinced that that is something that is around the corner or really even in the near future. And, you know, for those maybe unfamiliar with Canadian politics, it's interesting, Dana, to note that when you talk about the Conservative Party, there's always fear-mongering. And a lot of the opponents, people who object to the Conservative Party, will throw all kinds of things out there to try and strike fear. They'll say, you know, abortion is somehow going to become illegal in this country. The death penalty is going to come back to Canada. I'm not convinced, same with electing judges, that those kinds of radical changes are in store, at least at this point, when we talk capital punishment or electing judges. And I think the abortion issue is long since passed. I don't see anybody really touching that at this point. So, you know, I think a lot of those fears are unfounded. There's no doubt we're in for some change. I don't think if you and I spoke in 5 years from now, we'd look back and say, geez, we hardly even recognize our system today compared to 5 years ago. I don't think the change is going to be that dramatic.
Mike McIntyre is here. You know, with the new Sun Media Television, Fox News of the North, if you call it, up here now, and the Conservatives, and how they've discussed broadcasting over the years, and how they've basically said that when they do get their majority, they're going to open it up and have more foreign competition, for lack of a better term. Will we see crime reported in Canada differently, a la Nancy Grace? Will we have a Mike McIntyre TV show on the Sun TV network?
You know, I think that possibly certainly exists, and Sun Media, they're only a couple weeks old now, of course, Sun TV, and they are promising to sort of, you know, change the landscape. And, you know, I think the problem that they are going to run into, and really any broadcaster is going to run into, is I don't know about you, that there's such a saturation of everything, and not just our market, but there's a saturation of media out there for everybody, and there's so many ways nowadays that you go about the news. And I'll use a perfect example. We just had the Osama bin Laden story, of course, the fact he was taken out and killed Sunday night. Huge, huge news story. Well, I can tell you, Dana, that I followed the majority of that story and continue to follow the majority of that story via Twitter.
Yeah.
It was Twitter where the story first broke, about an hour before the president went on all the news stations to announce what had happened. Twitter was already filled with not only the news of bin Laden's death, but already instant analysis, background, you name it, debate, discussion. And so I think these days, I mean, people are turning to so many different sources, and there's that need for instantaneous that even electronic media, traditional electronic media, are having a real hard time meeting that demand. And I just worry that at some point, you know, it all starts to sound kind of like white noise to people, in that there are so many options. You know, there's hundreds of specialty channels you can tune into. And I just wonder today, I mean, the way people are getting their news is so different than what it used to be. Even the definition of a journalist is changing. I mean, anybody, you know, with access to a computer these days can be a journalist. They can be a blogger. And we've seen examples that a lot of times it's these unknowns, these, you know, untrained individuals who are actually breaking big stories.
Yep. No, absolutely. Mike McIntyre is here, and with Sun TV and Fox News of the North, and the conservatives talking about deregulation, and they've done that for years. You remember the old days, Mike, when they with the satellite DirecTV in Canada, and how we were making it illegal to watch HBO in Canada.
Yes.
That now that those days may change, but you're right. With such a glut of options, who's going to want to watch all this stuff? And with the blogs,
and who has the time? You know, one quick thing I could see with a conservative government and some of their crime-based platforms, I think we could be on the verge in the next few years of seeing some fairly significant changes as it comes to people's access to our courts. And again, people in the U.S. will say, well, geez, this is nothing new. We can have cameras in the courtroom down here. Up in Canada, nothing of the sort goes on. And I think, and we're already seeing different levels of judges, lawyers, governments, open to the idea of a more transparent justice system. And so that, you know, I could see that becoming a big change in the next few years, that, you know, you may start to see sentencing hearings and high profile trials being made available, whether it's online streaming or through different television networks, and giving people the access, the type of access that right now they just do not have in this country. That would be very interesting to see how that goes over and if that indeed were to happen, but I think it's a very real possibility, especially with all the technology that's now out there.
You know, last night, sitting down, you had the federal election results, the Bruins-Flyers game, which I watched, or Osama bin Laden to choose from, or I think Dancing with the Stars or whatever. It's interesting because the public now has gone through this election for the last 5 weeks and all the nonsense that went through that. We're seeing and hearing a lot about Osama bin Laden, and we'll probably see a picture of him here in the next little while. The next big story will come out shortly about something. We just don't know what it's about. But how does Mike McIntyre, the reporter for the Winnipeg Free Press, look at the election results and the new government, and how you will do your job, or will tomorrow just be the same old, same old?
Well, I think I speak for all of my colleagues who are electioned out, so to speak. There's just been too much, too soon. I think there's a sense of relief. No doubt there was a lot of excitement in some real change, you know, some governmental change coming to this country. But I think the fact there's a majority government, regardless of what party line you toe, I think there's some degree of a sense of relief that all right, maybe now we can, you know, put aside all this sort of three-ring circus-like nonsense that seems to have dominated government for the last few years, and have some stability in this country. You know, we know that we're not going to the polls again for another 4 years now in Canada. We're not going to have a snap election 6 months, 12 months, 18 months from now. So I think there's some relief there, and as you know, Dana, the news cycle never seems to stop. There's always going to be some scandal, some controversy, be it local, national, or international, to discuss. So I don't think those in the news business are all that panicked about, you know, what's going to be the next big story. There always seems to be something. Sadly, we've seen it, especially especially in 2011, it's just been one thing after another, whether it's, you know, natural disasters, earthquakes and tornadoes that we just saw down in the U.S. last week, just absolutely devastating. You know, there's always something going on, and that news cycle will continue to churn out all kinds of stories, I think, in the near future.
Absolutely. And just before we end up, I know it's only Tuesday, but what's coming up on Sunday's show?
Well, and it's funny because we always seem, whenever we do these interviews, it always seems to be in advance of my monthly segment. But once again, this definitely holds true. Judge Ray Wyant, an appointed judge, not an elected judge. Judge Ray Wyant, fantastic guy, does something in Canada that very few judges would have the courage to do, and that is take live calls on a national radio program. But Judge Ray Wyant will be joining me in taking folks' calls. We'll also have more on a very interesting story, Dana, that's sort of still in the breaking stage and involves most of Western Canada. It has to do with a high school teacher in Manitoba, 32 years old, who supposedly began dating his 16-year-old student, and together they went on the run, were the subject of a manhunt that ended last night in British Columbia with the arrest of the teacher on some sex charges and the recovery of the young girl. It's a scandal, to say the least, and we'll have more on that story as well.
Absolutely. It's the Crime and Punishment Radio Show. It's Sunday nights on the Chorus and Ralco Radio Networks, and Mike's webpage, mikeoncrime.com. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Dana. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Mike McIntyre, crime reporter for the Winnipeg Free Press, and if you get a chance to listen to his radio show, Crime and Punishment, it's a good one. You don't hear too many of them like that. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we are right back. We're going to end the show a few minutes early tonight. I got a couple of other commitments, but always my commitment is to you. Make sure and check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you can pick up the show live, podcasts of past shows, commentaries, leave comments, whatever. And, of course, the blog site is scaredmonkeys.com. We'll see you again here real soon on the Dana Pretzer Show. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.